Good. So we've been looking at Milarepa over the last couple of months or so, and we haven't really said very much about the practice that Milarepa is renowned for. He's a master of this practice. He's an enlightened master of this practice. And the practice in the Tibetan tradition is called Mahamudra. And Mahamudra, well, you can translate it, but I don't know if the translation will reveal very much. Maha means great, and mudra can be translated as seal or gesture. So sometimes it's translated as the great seal, not the seal that as in flipper and whatever, or not some sort of sea thing. Seal as in seal as in when you seal a letter, the great seal. Although that doesn't help you either, does it? It might as well be the other type of seal for all that, that helps you. So, well, I'm just going to use the term Mahamudra rather than get myself into more hot water. And what I want to explore is what Mahamudra has to say about the nature of reality. And I'm not quite sure how successful I'm going to be, because partly I'm not an expert in Mahamudra, and partly the sort of thing that I'm trying to talk about is it's sort of uncommunicable. It's sort of uncommunicable because one of the fundamental kind of principles around when you start talking about the nature of reality from a Buddhist perspective, one of the fundamental things that you've got to say is, because the Buddha said this, is that the nature of reality is beyond all concepts. It's atakavachara, which means it's beyond the sphere of reason. What the Buddha said is that no concepts, no rational thought, no ideas can grasp the nature of what's going on. And when I say the nature of reality, I don't mean reality as in something out there. I mean your experience and my experience right now. If we were to look at it really closely, what is going on in experience? It is said to be beyond the nature of all concepts. All concepts are sort of falsifications. They try and grasp something. They try and capture something that can't be grasped, can't be captured. They're falsifications. They falsify what's actually happening in experience. But nevertheless, some concepts point to the nature of things more than other concepts. Yeah. So what Buddhism says is that you do need to use concepts. You can't just say it's unconceptual, so let's just forget about it. Because the enlightened mind does see things truly. That's part of the definition of what the enlightened mind is. And if we want to move towards enlightenment, we have to have a certain idea of what seeing things truly might be like. Yeah, and for that, for us unenlightened people, we'll need some concepts to help orient us, to help sort of point the way. Even though we really know that, we have to bear in mind at least, that those concepts aren't it, they're just pointers. If you grasp them too literally, then they become obstacles. Yeah. But we do need concepts because some concepts are evidently unhelpful. Yeah, they actually are deterrents. If you hold certain concepts, they're really unhelpful. Yeah. So I'm going to try and use some concepts to point to something that is beyond all concepts, and I'm going to use a framework that, in a way, comes from the tradition, Milarepa's tradition, from the Kagyu tradition. this Mahamudra framework. You have to see it just as a framework, not as literally true, because nothing fits absolutely into any framework. The framework is too narrow to hold any true experience of reality. So before I introduce the Mahamudra framework, we need to dismiss or shatter as much as we can our ordinary common sense view of what's going on in experience. Because what Buddhism says is that this ordinary common sense view that we have is completely wrong. Yeah? And it's so completely wrong that it doesn't help us move towards enlightenment. In fact, it becomes an obstacle to seeing things as they really are. So by a common sense view, and in a way this is so basic to our assumptions, by a common sense view what I mean is something like there's a real me somewhere in here having the experience that I'm having, and there's a real objective world out there to be experienced. Yeah? So there's a real me, a real subject of the experience, and a real objective world out there of things and people and... Yeah, things and people probably cover it. things and people out there to be experienced. There's a real objective world, and there's a real me in here having this experience of the world, as if I have been plonked into an objectively existing universe, and I go around experiencing it. And sometimes the experience is pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. Now that is a common sense view, isn't it? Yeah. And you might think, well, what's wrong with that? In fact, it's so sort of common sense that you think to even question it is madness. Yeah? Do you agree? Mm-hmm. So what is wrong with it? Can you say? How do you know that that's not true? That's a hard question, isn't it?
Well, because the world is an objective, and we interpret the world.
Yeah, we interpret the world rather than see it. That's so. Can you say any more, Tobias? I think that's a really that is the way in, or can be a way in, to undermining this common sense view. The world is not objective. We interpret it rather than just see it as it is. Don't know if you want to say any more, or shall I?
That's a lot already.
That's a lot already, right? I was hoping that you might sort of save me the trouble of trying to unpack what is
it. Just the experience that, you know, one day the world looks a certain way and another day the world looks totally different.
Yeah.
So just becoming more aware of the filters that are at play.
Exactly.
And how my state of mind is part of the world that I'm having.
Exactly. So that's really, really good. So for example, if I am in a very, very happy mood, I don't know, imagine you've just fallen in love, the world will look radiant. I know that's a way of talking, but it's got some truth. It's like even your visual faculty, everything will look brighter. Or if you've just been on retreat, when you're on a retreat, everything shines a little bit more clearly. And then your encounters with other people tend to be more meaningful and positive. And your perspective on situations, even difficult situations, feels freer. there's a sense of expansiveness. Conversely, if you're in a state of, say, depression, the world, other people experience is really heavily coloured by that hellish mental state. So nothing has any meaning. Or if it does have meaning, it's a negative meaning. Everything is pointing downwards. And those states of mind they're like filters, as Tobias says, but we can't escape from being in some state of mind. It might not be one of those two extremes, but we're always in some state of mind, aren't we? There isn't an interpretation that is without any filters. Yeah? At least this side of enlightenment. Enlightenment, you could say, is a state of mind that doesn't impose any filters on reality. But this side of enlightenment, we're always in some state of mind, more or less positive. Incidentally, what Buddhism would say is that some of those interpretations are more true. So actually, when you are in that very positive state and everything's shining more brightly, that filter is less opaque than when you're more depressed. Yeah. So it's not that all the filters are equivalent. When you are in that very, very heightened positive state, you're seeing things more as they are, according to the Buddha. There's another way in which we interpret the world, which is, I think, even more sort of shocking and radical, which is that all of our experience comes through the five senses, doesn't it? I mean, maybe this is a simplification, but take this model as it is. All of our experience comes through the five senses of sight and sound and touch and taste and hearing. And then all of those sense inputs have to be interpreted by the mind in order to become experience. Yeah. Otherwise, the sense apparatus is just like, it's not going to, if the mind isn't active, if the mind isn't working, you won't have sense experience. So you get some sort of sense input, and then it's interpreted by the mind. But the senses themselves, our eyes, if you just take our eyes as one example of the senses themselves are filters. Yeah? They interpret, and the mind is another filter. So for example, if we had different types of eyes, we would literally see the world differently. Yeah? So for example, if our eyes were... Yeah, you could be colourblind. A colourblind person would literally see, I don't know, red and green differently. If we had eyes that operated in the infrared spectrum, part of the spectrum, you would see, or we would see heat as a colour. It would literally be a colour, not just a felt experience, it would be a colour. If we had eyes that operated also in the X-ray spectrum, we would see through seemingly solid objects. We know that the electromagnetic spectrum is much, much vaster than the narrow visible spread that we call visible light. Yeah? And that's only because that's the type of eyes human beings have evolved. So you can't say that we're seeing things completely as they are. Our eyes are a filter on what we see. Yeah? A bat navigates through this sense of sound. For a bat, sound is the equivalent of sight for us. And what's more, the sound, the echoes and the sound that the bat makes are inaudible to the human ear. So it's almost unimaginable the world that the bat experiences. Yeah, the experience of being a bat is almost unimaginably different to the experience of being a human. But you can't say which is more true. Is the bat experience of the world more true? Or is the human experience of the world more true? Different animals will just have different experiences. So if you were one of these sort of insects that float on water or walk on water like a water boatman, water would appear, would feel like a solid surface feels to us. To us, water has this property that we call liquid. It flows. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that our human perception and our human experience of reality is filtered through the types of sense apparatus that we have. It doesn't reveal necessarily what's out there. It's filtered through our apparatus, and our apparatus colours it, it conditions it. So even, let me go back to this sense of sight. So even if we just take a simple colour like orange, there's this flower here that looks to me at least orange. I can't tell whether my experience of this colour is the same as your experience of this colour. We do have a common word for it, but no way is there of knowing whether your experience is the same as mine. But if you look at this orange, this colour, well, as a scientist will tell you, as a physicist will tell you, colour doesn't exist as an intrinsic property of the flower. Colour is an experience that is experienced in the mind. It does depend on something that the flower is doing, as it were. But, for example, if I turn the lights off, then it won't be orange anymore. You won't see a thing. So partly, it depends on light being available. A physicist will tell you that light is just part of this electromagnetic... it's an electromagnetic field or force. There's a certain wavelength of light that is bouncing off the surface of this flower, entering our eyes, and being interpreted by our mind as this experience of colour, in this case, the experience of orange. But it is just light of a particular wavelength. Orange doesn't exist in the flower. Do you see what I mean? Something is going on, but you can't say it's orange. And what's more, we don't know what light is, do we? I mean, I've just glibly said, oh, it's electromagnetic radiation or electromagnetic force or a field. That's what physicists say. But if you probe more deeply, you don't actually know what that means. Something really mysterious is going on all the time. And yes, there are laws. It's not random. It's not completely chaotic. Like this now isn't suddenly turning pink. It sort of seems to remain orange. Although it will change, won't it? As the flower dies, the colour will change. So something else is going on. And it's not what we common sense think it is. We just say, oh, this is an orange flower. As if orange is a property of the flower. But what I've just described as the property of sight, you can also extend to the other senses. So when you hear... you're hearing my voice at the moment, or you might hear a passing car outside. Well, we know, don't we, that hearing is pressure waves in the air that then are caught by your ears and the apparatus of your ears, and there's vibration. And then that vibration is interpreted again by the mind, by consciousness. Also by the brain, something's going on in the brain, and you experience it as sound. Yeah? You experience it as sound. And then, because here we all understand English, those sounds then have particular meanings that we have ascribed to them. and they relate to particular ideas and concepts that your brain is also processing. That's weird, isn't it? It's weird that I can say something, you can hear it, and understand it. Something very, very mysterious is going on there. I mean, if we didn't have air, that wouldn't happen. Yeah. If you didn't have your ears, it wouldn't happen. If our ears were attuned to a different frequency, my voice would be very different, wouldn't it? Or you wouldn't hear it, etc., etc. So not only do our moods filter our experience, but our very senses are filters, they're interpretive apparatus for experience. We don't actually know what the world is like independent of our experience of it. We don't even know what a bad experience is. But imagine if we had completely different senses or no senses at all. Could you really say this flower was orange if there was nobody to look at it? Because if there's nobody to look at it, well, what would electromagnetic radiation look like bouncing off this electromagnetic radiation of a particular frequency? If there was nobody to look at it, could you say it was orange? Yep. So, do you have any questions on any of that? Shall I just move on? It might be safer to move on. All I've done there is try to shake up a common sense view on our experience. Yeah.
The fact that we don't have direct access to what reality is like.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Show that there's no such thing as an objective reality and a subjective experience.
No. So far, it doesn't show that. All I've said is that our common sense interpretation can't be true. Yeah. But it doesn't say what might be true.
I think that's the confusing thing when you are kind of flitting between true and untrue. Bill.
Go on.
Well, me, personally at the moment, I seem to be flitting quite frequently on a day-by-day basis. You know, like, I don't know, I've become quite sensitive to true and untrue.
Sure.
I can really feel when it's untrue.
Right, yeah.
And it kind of, like, it's more jarring than when it's true. When it's true, it feels better.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a kind of in-out situation.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things when you meditate and you practice the Dharma is that your perception starts to change, or you start to become a little bit more attuned to the filters that you're imposing. Because your mind changes. You become more sensitive, yeah. Hopefully you also become more, in time, it might not always feel like this, but if you keep practicing, you become more emotionally alive and more emotionally positive. You become happier, and then that changes your experience of the world. So again, this is going back to sort of states of mind, but you try it. I mean, I try it in sort of walking down the street, conjure up this sense of metta, wish people well as you're walking down the street, and you're likely to have different encounters with people. I was doing it this weekend. I went to the Tate Britain and on the tube, and I was just trying to wish people well, or I was just in a good state. It wasn't particularly trying, but I was, and there were so many encounters where people smiled, I smiled back. It was a very different experience of being in the world. So that goes back to our mental state, and then what I've said is that our very senses condition our experience. Yeah. Okay, so I want to move on. All I've done there is sort of challenge some common sense assumptions about what's going on. I haven't talked about the Mahamudra position yet. I want to take that a little bit further by talking about the nature of being aware. Something that's going on all the time that we take for granted is that we are aware. We're conscious. And that very... Without awareness, we wouldn't have any experience at all, would we? If we weren't conscious, if we weren't aware, and I'm using the two terms synonymously, if you weren't aware, you wouldn't have any experience. So we take for granted this notion of awareness, of being aware, but we don't know what awareness is. If you try and say, what is awareness? It's really, really... You get into paradox. You don't know what it is. Now, some people would say that awareness is a byproduct of neurons just firing in your brain. The brain is a complex organism, and it's probably the most complex structure known in the universe. So it's an incredibly complex organism. And what our scientific materialist view would be is that awareness, the ability to be conscious, is an effect, a byproduct of the brain. Yeah? Are you familiar with that view, that actually we're just brains, we're biological machines? The trouble is that you can't prove that. You can't prove... the brain does seem to have something to do with our quality of awareness, but it's not obvious. It's just a philosophically not obvious. In fact, it's impossible to say philosophically how atoms or neurons or matter, no matter how complex it is, can lead to this experience of orange or of any experience at all. How can simple material substance lead to aware experience? And a scientist can't really answer that. And philosophers have tried. But in philosophy, it's known as the hard problem. The hard problem. Yeah? There are lots of other problems in philosophy. But this is known as the hard problem of what is consciousness. What is consciousness? How does consciousness, how do you explain it? How does it arise? So, are you with me so far? That what I'm trying to do is just say we don't really know what's out there because our experience is filtered by our minds and our senses. And what's more, we don't know what it is to be aware in the first place. I mean, we don't know what awareness is. We experience something through awareness, but we don't actually know what consciousness is, what it is to be aware. What's more, neither does anybody else know. Even though people will tell you, Brian Cox will tell you that awareness is a byproduct of your brain. But frankly, he doesn't know that. He doesn't know that. Clever though he might be, he's rather silly if he thinks he knows that. All he can say is that the brain seems to affect awareness. Yeah? You with me so far? Okay. So if awareness isn't just a byproduct of the brain, well, how do you explain things like when somebody has damage to the brain, their awareness changes? How do you explain that? Yeah? Because the scientists would say that's evidence that the brain is actually the cause of awareness. The brain is the source of awareness. You still with me? Yeah? I don't want you falling asleep if you're lying down. So stay with me, and if you lose track, then just ask.
Sorry, can you just say that one last thing again?
Yeah. No. possibly. I think what I was saying is that if awareness isn't just a byproduct of the brain, which is what Buddhism is saying, that it's not just a byproduct of the brain, then how do you explain that when the brain, for example, is damaged or changed in some way, that awareness changes? Yeah? So that's a a sort of question leading to an argument. That you know, those that argue that awareness is just part of the brain, it is a byproduct of the brain, would say, look, you can alter the brain, you can damage the brain, numb the brain, and your awareness will change. Okay. You had a question, was that a clarification question around that?
Was there a difference between awareness and... Because I think the brain complicates things quite a lot and thinks rather than feels.
Let's not speculate just yet.
Yeah.
See if you want... if there's clarification about... about what I've said so far.
Yeah, I guess awareness for me is more than the brain, but it must need the brain.
Right. Yeah, so in a way that's what I'm trying to get at, is that I think that's right. Now, I'm not enlightened, I don't know what's going on either, but all I'm trying to say is that it needn't be what Brian Cox and the other scientists are saying. So, for example, an alternative model of what's going on could be that consciousness is not... The brain isn't the source of consciousness, but the brain is like a receiver of consciousness. The brain is like a receiver of consciousness. So, for example, if you have a radio and you tune it to a particular frequency, you will pick up radio waves that are in the atmosphere, in the universe, as it were. But you wouldn't say that the radio was the source of those radio waves. Actually, the radio waves are being transmitted somewhere from somewhere else. All you would say is that the radio is an apparatus that is a receiver of those radio waves and makes them into sound. Yeah? So, for example, if you damage the radio or change the frequency, the change the dial, then you won't pick up radio waves. So it could be that consciousness is being, as it were, mediated by the brain. The brain isn't necessarily the source of consciousness, but it's a receiver for consciousness. And if you damage the brain, then yes, you won't receive consciousness. Do you see what I mean? But it's a necessary bit of kit in order to have experience, but it needn't be the source of that consciousness. It needn't be the source of awareness. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Another example would be, you know, you have a prism, and white light passing through a prism spreads out in the rainbow. Yeah. If you remove the prism, the rainbow disappears. Yeah. But you wouldn't say that the prism is the source of the rainbow. It's the white light passing through that was the source of the rainbow, but the prism does something to that white light, makes it visible. So that's another model. All I'm saying is that you've got these different kind of models, but it's not that particular model isn't one that you normally hear about in our Western scientific materialist culture. It is, however, a little bit more true to what the Buddhist model would be. The Buddhist model would be, and this is where we're coming on, starting to come on to what Milarepa espoused, the Buddhist model would be that consciousness is primary. That consciousness is first, if you like, and matter, this solid stuff, arises out of consciousness. It's not the other way around. So a Western common sense scientific perspective would say that consciousness arises from the brain. Buddhism would almost say the other way around, that the organism, this organism, including the brain, arises from consciousness. That consciousness is primary. Now that's weird, isn't it? It's a weird notion. All I'm saying is that it might be weird that you can't say that it's no more valid as a model than our common sense models, because our common sense models are weird too. They don't hold up. Yeah.
I was with you up until the point of the brain being receiver.
Yeah.
The one.
Yeah.
But I can't sort of get the possibility that the brain. What did you say?
That consciousness is primary. But the
consciousness may be primary, but to say that then matter or the brain has come out of it, you know, is a product of it.
Is a manifestation of it, maybe, would be a better way of putting it.
That sounds as implausible as the earlier.
It does in a way, doesn't it? That consciousness arises from matter.
Yeah. I can see that they're two separate things, and that consciousness might be, you know, the white light, and the brain is the prism.
Sure.
But to say that the prism arose out of the white light, that I don't get.
Doesn't make sense either.
Yeah.
So I think you've just got a problem, and I don't know what the answer is either. But you've got a problem. On the one hand, you've got this stuff called consciousness, whatever that is, and we don't know what that is. On the other hand, you've got matter, and we don't actually know what that is either. Yeah? Now, if they're two different things, like Descartes said, if they were completely two different things, how do they interact? How does matter receive consciousness or vice versa? How do they interact at all if they're completely different things? Yeah. What Western science does is it tries to reduce those two different things to one thing.
Mm.
It says there's only matter. Yeah, there's only matter. And it's sort of dead matter. But if it becomes complex enough, one of the byproducts of it is what we experience as consciousness. Yeah? It reduces the two things to one thing. And tries to explain the arising of consciousness through matter. Okay? We're in the realm of metaphysics now. That's deeply mysterious, that argument. I know neuroscientists might sort of trot it out, but it's deeply mysterious how one can be aware from just a bunch of matter that was dead. If it was dead and not aware, then how does it become aware? Yeah. Another perspective would be to reduce everything to consciousness and say everything is consciousness and that matter arises from consciousness. Yeah. Now that feels more unfamiliar, but it's no more mysterious or implausible in your terms than the other one. Yeah. Or another one would be that they're two different things, but then you don't know how they relate. How do we ever have experience in this body? Because we are both matter and consciousness in this form. So something weird is going on, and we don't have an answer. Western philosophy calls it the hard problem. Buddhism says that it's beyond the sphere of reason. No concepts are going to be adequate to this issue of what's going on. Yeah, but some concepts are going to be more adequate than others. Yeah. Now, what Buddhism says is that the concept that is more adequate is to think in terms of consciousness being primary. If we think in terms of matter being dead, we live in a dead universe. Say we just live in an inert, dead universe where nothing is alive, and somehow we've been plonked into it as conscious beings. But, you know, this is dead, this is dead, this is dead. It's not conscious. If we live in that sort of universe, if that's the truth, then what Buddhism says is that enlightenment isn't possible. So the Buddhist notion of the universe, and it's as weird as anything, is that everything, in a sense, is alive. In a sense, everything is conscious. It's not just that our brains have suddenly become conscious. Consciousness is all that there is. And matter is the outer manifestation of consciousness. Consciousness is what is the inner bit of matter. The inner experience of matter is what we call consciousness. Matter is, as it were, the outer manifestation of consciousness. That they're not completely separate. So that would mean that everything that you can point to, like this mug, is conscious to some degree or other. And I guess what Buddhism would say is that yes, it is, but to a very much lower degree than human beings are conscious. So there's this kind of spectrum of awareness. There's a spectrum, this gradient of awareness. And some organisations of matter are more aware than others. Yeah? But nothing is completely dead, inert. Everything, it would be better to think of everything as alive, as conscious, at least to some degree. That's really weird, isn't it?
It's not that weird, because no. Even science doesn't posit that matter is dead.
No.
Matter's energy.
And energy might have a consciousness dimension to it. Yeah? Yeah.
I mean, that was what I was going to say. I mean,
matter is just energy.
It's just molecules that are...
Exactly. And when you go beneath at smaller levels to subatomic levels, to particles, they can just manifest out of energy and disappear, as it were, back into energy. And what's more, if you're working at that level, you need quantum physics. That's the best theory that we've got of what's happening at the most microscopic subatomic level. And at that subatomic level, matter behaves in a weird way. So these subatomic particles change according to what you're looking for. Yeah? They sometimes behave as waves, they sometimes behave as particles, depending on what you are looking for. And they change instantaneously depending on what you're looking for. If they behave as waves, they spread out and they can be in two places, more than one place at once. That's not common for our notion of a particle. So all I'm saying is that our best notions of what matter is are deeply, deeply mysterious, to the point where they confound common sense, they're paradoxical. Yeah? Let alone our notions of what consciousness is. We do not know what's going on at all. Okay, so that's good. I hope I've convinced you. I'm going to move on, because I've not got any real time to talk about Milarepa's position of Mahamudra otherwise. So I'm going to move on. So Milarepa's position, or Mahamudra position, it's a model, remember, and I'm just going to throw it out there to you, would say that it would be closer to say that everything is mind, everything is of the nature of consciousness. Everything is the nature of consciousness. So, if that's true, then it doesn't make sense to think in terms either of an inert universe out there, and it doesn't completely make sense to even think that there's a completely separate objective universe out there. Or at least, if there is, we don't know what it is. Because everything that we can experience is experienced through the mind and through our senses. So, if there is something out there, independent of the mind and the senses, we don't know what it looks like. Yeah? We don't know what it feels like, tastes like, touches like. All of those experiences happening through our senses. Philosophy, idealist philosophy, and some Buddhist philosophy goes a step further and says, if you don't know what's really out there, do you need to even posit an out there? Is there really an out there? Can you just not say there's experience? All that we know is our experience. That's a sort of Western idealist position. Kant would have espouse that. Maybe Kant was the first Western philosopher to have a worked out metaphysics that say that this notion of an objective reality is flawed. So anyway, Milarepa would have said there's just experience. There's just experience. We don't know if there's a real out there or not. We are, all that we can say is that we're having experience. Okay. He would have also said that experience is of the nature of mind. Everything that we experience is of the nature of mind. He would have then said mind is ungraspable. Consciousness is ungraspable, which means that you cannot actually think about it. I know we've got a word, awareness or consciousness, we've got several words, mind, I've just used, but those words can't grasp what it is. And thought can't grasp it because thought is in awareness. So how can thought grasp awareness? When you think, that is you being aware. When I think, do you see what I mean? When we have any experience, that is us being aware. Awareness is necessary for all experience. You can't make an object, make it an object of experience. It can't become an object. So it's ungraspable in that sense. And then, what Milarepa would say, or the Mahamudra position would say, is that yes, everything is of the nature of mind, and mind keeps arising in endless forms, endless different forms. It's just bubbling up as energy. And energy, I mean, energy might be a better way of thinking about it, actually. If you think in terms of energy, there's just energy, but that energy isn't inert, it's of the nature of consciousness. And that energy is manifesting, bubbling up as form all the time. What we think of as matter is this energy made concrete for a while. Yeah? Even then it's not fixed, it's constantly jittering and moving. And that energy is in some way not different to consciousness. It's alive. So everything is of this nature of mind or of energy, and it's constantly manifesting as form. Any, are you following so far? Okay, and then lastly, what Milarepa would say, what Mahamudra would say, is that these forms, this manifestation, does obey certain laws. There are certain natural laws. It's not random. There are laws. So it's not chaos. There are sort of natural laws that govern how energy manifests and forms manifest. But it's doing it all the time. This manifestation is happening all the time. And it doesn't need this notion of an objective or subjective universe. It's just endlessly arising. We are that energy made form, as is everything else. We're not separate from that. It's not like there's an inert universe and then we've been plonked into it. There is just energy manifesting or mind manifesting, and we are part of that, and all our experience is part of that. Everything is part of that. That's pretty weird, isn't it? So, the key thing here from a Dharmic perspective is that if we can start to, you don't have to take this on trust, but if you can start to loosen your common sense assumptions, at least in meditation, loosen your common sense assumptions, at least in meditation, it can lead to a freedom that the Buddha called enlightenment. So our basic common sense assumption in meditation and in life in general is that there's a real me and a real world out there. What I've tried to do is undermine, just using reasoning, I've tried to undermine that common sense assumption. Buddhism would say that those common sense assumptions are wrong, and all of our delusions are based on thinking that there's a real fixed me and a real fixed out there world. And that delusion, it's not just a theoretical problem, it is the root of all of our suffering. All of our suffering is based on a sense that there's a real fixed, separate thing called me, plonked in this real, existing, out there world. And the world doesn't seem to match my desires. Yeah? I've got yearnings and desires that the world keeps refusing to meet, and therefore I suffer. And that's the human condition as we normally experience it. The enlightened mind wouldn't experience it in that way. The enlightened mind would say, there's no real fixed entity that's me. There's no real fixed out there objective world. There is just endlessly fascinating arising of experience that is just manifest, this energy is just manifesting as experience in its endless different forms. And because there's no sense of me, there's no sense that it won't meet my expectations. There is just what there is. And the enlightened mind just revels in that freedom. If you let go of the sense of me, actually what arises is bliss and freedom and joy and beauty and love. That's what arises. That's what the enlightened mind experiences. That's what the Buddha represents. And the reason that we don't experience that, that I don't experience that most of the time, is because I am stuck in this framework that says there's a real me and a real out there. Yeah? Something is going on. So Buddhism's not saying that it's all not happening. Something's happening. It's just that we've misinterpreted our experience. And we've misinterpreted it really badly. Like, really badly. Like, really got it wrong.
But why did we get it wrong?
Why did we get it wrong? The Buddha didn't answer that. He said that it's... from a Buddhist position, he says this ignorance, this tendency to get it wrong, we've had it in a previous life, and we've carried it on. But then, why did we have it in a previous life? Because we had it in the life before. And there's this endless chain. Buddhism doesn't have a first beginning. It doesn't say that there was this first point. It's just that there is ignorance. That's one answer. That's what the Buddha answered. From another perspective, you could say, from an evolutionary perspective, we've evolved, haven't we, as a species from simpler species. And at some point, it was useful in this evolutionary process for survival to have a real sense of me. Yeah? If we didn't have a real sense of me, an animal sense of me, then we might not have survived. For the flight or fight response, it's quite useful to have a sense of me and an outside world, because then you can say, oh, that outside world is about to eat me, I better run. Yeah? So it's quite useful at that simple level. What Buddhism says is that, yes, it's useful for survival, but it's not true. It's still a delusion. It's still an ignorant model. And because it's not true, yes, it's okay for survival, but it doesn't lead to ultimate fulfillment.
What if it... I don't know that I buy the true and not true, but it seems to me that it's not sufficient.
Okay.
That you could retain a sense that you are individual,
yeah,
but that viewpoint in and of itself isn't a sufficient understanding of the world.
Well, that might be a more sophisticated way of thinking about it. Because when I say that there's no fixed, separate, real me, that doesn't mean that we've just got soup it doesn't just mean that we're going to sort of merge into some sort of cosmic consciousness and lose our individuality. It doesn't mean that. It means that there are distinctions going on, but they're not absolute distinctions. That might be a more sophisticated way of looking at it. So for example, look at clouds in the sky. You can point to a cloud. Imagine a big white fluffy cloud, because it's nicer. So a big white fluffy cloud, you can point to it and say, there it is, that's a cloud. And for ordinary purposes, that's sufficient, as you say. But if you want to look at it more truly, more accurately, then when you start to look at it, you realise that it's just a process. That there are no real distinct edges to the cloud. And what's more, there's nothing fixed about it. It's constantly arising and ceasing. It's constantly changing. Yeah? And that's what Buddhism would say, is that we are like clouds. There is some sort of process going on, but it's not a fixed entity. We're not fixed, and there's no real boundaries. And not just we, but everything. We're manifestations, ever-changing manifestations of this stuff called mind or energy or whatever it is. We don't know what it is. So that might be truer. Depends how accurately you want to look. And for everyday purposes, our common sense view works. You know, going home on the tube tonight, you don't want to question whether the tube really exists or you really exist. You just want to get on it and get home and get to bed. So for common sense purposes, it works. But it's not absolutely true. And because it's not absolutely true, it never quite fulfills the deepest longings of the human heart. Something's gone wrong. So all I'm trying to do is say there are other views, and the Buddhist perspective that I've just tried to describe, it's still a model. Reality is beyond all models. It's still a model. But what the Buddhists taught, what Milarepa taught, is that that model is more useful for overcoming suffering and experiencing freedom and bliss and joy and love than other models. So as a working model, it's a better one if you want to move towards enlightenment. And enlightenment, if you do move towards it, leads to, in a way, the complete fulfilment of, well, everything in our human potential. It is said to be the ultimate fulfilment of all of our yearnings, all of our desires. If we really saw things as they are, we wouldn't have any sense of fear, any sense of loss, any sense of craving. We would be content. In fact, we would be blissfully content. And we wouldn't have any sense of ultimate separation from anybody else and anything else. We would experience a deep sense of connectedness with the whole of the universe around us. And our natural response to that connectedness would be love. It would be metta. There would be nothing else in our experience apart from metta in our emotional world. That feels to me like worth striving for and worth looking at what gets in the way of that, and our common sense assumptions get in the way of that ultimately. So I'm going to leave it there before you pick holes in my argument and find ways of objecting. I'm going to leave it there with me having the last word and say that next week Subhadra Mathi is going to carry on looking at Milarepa. So come next week, and I think it might be our final week on Milarepa, so make sure you're there. Good. Thank you very much.